back four of the harder and four. My four got a hot and wouldn't do no more. The gun got cloud and started to rain. I tooted my horn for the passing lane. The rainwater blowing all under my hood. I knew that was doing my motor good. Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started back doing the thing you used to do.
Welcome to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. Got a jam-packed show tonight. We got Phil Angotti. Going to play some live music in a little bit. But we're going to lead off with our friend Marshall Chess, who was so gracious to join us last week. How you doing, Marshall?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing okay. Now, we taped our segment last week. Listeners can find that on the Nocturnal Journal Facebook page and at WGNradio.com. But since we taped it, when we were on last week, Chuck Berry passed away. So
yeah.
Thanks for joining us. I just wanted to wrap up the interview with talking about Chuck. When I talked to you earlier this week, I know there's so many great songs you could pick. I asked your favorite. You told me Maybelline changed your life. Pick up the story from there.
Changed my life. I have numerous Maybelline stories. The first one is, it's the summer of 1955. I'm 13 years old. I was even going to work back then. I was with my father on the outer drive, and he used to punch the buttons on the radio, listening to all the different radio stations, WGES, WOPA. That day, he pushed the button, and I heard Chuck Berry sing Maybelline. My father got so excited and happy. You know, I didn't often see him that way. I said, what's happening? What's happening? He said, we've made it. It's Howard Miller on the white radio station playing our record, Maybelline. And, you know, it was mind-boggling. And my life really changed then because Chess was a blues label. And, you know, blues records sold 10,000 on a lot of them, it was like. And there weren't even record shops in black neighborhoods in most of America. So this was our first crossover record. It was the first record that white radio really played a lot. It was the birth of rock and roll. It spread across the country. And my uncle often tells the story that my father went on the road promoting Maybelline. He was in New York. His first stop was with Alan Freed, the famous disc jockey who actually coined the words rock and roll. And there was no cell phones back then, so, you know, my dad did it, whatever he had to do. He got to Cleveland, his next stop, and he called my uncle to check in. My uncle said, what's happening? What's happening? The phones are going crazy. We're getting all kinds of calls for that new record, Maybelline. And Alan Freed had just been playing it back-to-back because the phones were ringing. You know, it was the birth of rock and roll, even though we had Rocket 88, which was considered one of the first rock and roll records by Jackie Brenson. Chuck was really the first one that crossed over big. So I'll continue the story. Maybe 10 years ago, my son, who was a third-generation record man, at that time he was in college, he said, I want to meet Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry was playing with his children as his backup band, his daughter and his son, at B.B. King's Club in Chicago. And I hadn't seen Chuck probably in 15 years, although we've talked many times. We never really had been together personally. So I went backstage, and we hadn't seen each other, and I knew him well. I knew him since I'm 13 and all the way into the 60s. And I said, you know, Chuck, I said, it's something I've always wanted to tell you, that you changed my whole life as a teenager. He said, what do you mean? I said, starting in 1955, everything changed. I got a three-speed Schwinn bicycle. My mother got something new. We got an air conditioner for the family room. And he looked at me and he took my hand and he said, you know, my life changed also when I met your father in 1955. So that was like such a beautiful story. And I feel sad that he's gone, though. He was 90. He lived a great long life.
And,
he played music up until a little while ago.
I was telling somebody today that really changed musical history in Chicago. I mean, what happened there when he came up to – what do you remember? You were young, but 4720 Cottage Grove, what do you know about
him? I don't remember that so much. The thing I remember – I was very young. I mean, I was working in this shipping room. But back then, in 1963, I think it was, he got out of prison. He was in prison for breaking a federal law, taking a young girl across a state line. And he came right from prison to Chicago. We were desperate. He was our biggest star, you know, the peak of his career to get go to prison. And he came to Chicago, and you know, they were planning to record that week just to get him back into action. He wanted it, and my dad and uncle wanted it. And my dad handed me, I was 21 back then, I was 63. He handed me a $100 bill, and he said, "Take Chuck down to State Street and get him some new clothes," you know. And I did, you know, and I took Chuck down, and he recorded Nadine at that session. You never can tell. I could close my eyes and remember it. It was one of the few Chuck Berry sessions that I was actually there, because I was working at Chess. I was 21. Earlier, I wasn't around in the studio. And I went on the road with him and became his road manager on the first gigs after that week. Very quickly, he needed to make money. And our first gig, I think it was in Flint, Michigan, with the Motown Rhythm Section backing him up.
Wow.
And yeah. And it was a little rough. He was all pickup bands, but he expected them to know all his classics by then. You know, it was 1963, 8 or 9 years after it started, that great string of hits he had.
How did he come to terms?
I had a lot of good Chuck stories. He was an amazing character, a brilliant poet. And him and Muddy, I think, him, Muddy, and Etta, they were like the royalty of the Chess artists to me.
Phil and I were sitting here talking before the show about musicians we know. I know pickup bands here in Chicago played with him, and there's all the, you know, carrying the money in the bag thing and all that. But there was a story in Billboard this week that said he left an estimated $50 million estate.
$17 million.
How did he come to terms with – I brought his book in, his autobiography, but how did he come to terms with your father and uncle on the money issues?
It was, you know, they never had a problem with my father. They were remained friends always. Chuck more than probably any other artist really understood what the deal was, the payola at that time to get the records played. I don't remember ever a problem about it at all. Other artists, yes, but not with Chuck. He was right. Chuck was like a street guy. He was different than a Mississippi blues artist. He'd been in jail once before when he was a teenager robbing a gas station. He understood a part of life that, you know, paying off to make it happen. I really understood that. I just never got the personal feeling that that was ever a problem, royalty-wise. I remember he came and talked to my dad when Mercury Records wanted to sign him. And the deal was so big, and my dad and him, they parted as friends because my dad told him, take the money and run. That's an amazing offer. So I think they always had a good friendship. Every time I've been around Chuck, he just speaks so fondly of my father. You know, he used to sleep at our house, at my uncle's house. They were friends.
Yeah.
My father was not friends with a lot of the Chess artists, you know. It was really not that kind of relationship, but he sure was with Chuck, definitely with Chuck and with Muddy. They were friends.
This will lead into some of the, Phil's going to play a Chuck Berry song, but man, when you hear that, and this is a lot of this has been coming out since Chuck's passing, but I mean, the speech, the rhythm, the song, about the way all three of those things come together into what he created.
How could a guy like that know? I used to see his spiral notebook where he wrote all those lyrics, like a high school spiral notebook. How does a guy like that know white psychology so well? That, to me, was always so brilliant when I got older to understand what he was doing. I mean, this was not riding around in an automobile that was not being done by black kids. That was a white thing, you know, back in that era.
Yeah,
he understood that white teen, that beginning of rock and roll thing. He was right onto it.
He really just shed a light on just the whole changing America. I mean, the hamburger stands, the cars.
Great poetry. And then, you know, then his guitar playing. I mean, in Japan, when I used to go around the world, you know, setting up the Chess catalog, in Japan, they loved Chuck Berry, but they loved him for his guitar and melody. They didn't even know his words. They had no idea what a great poet he was.
What do you think, coming to Chicago and playing with some of these Chicago guys, like rock and roll music, and having Lafayette Leak on piano and stuff, what do you think?
I think it was a great influence on him. I mean, the reason he came to Chicago to begin with was he wanted to be a blues singer. That was the afterthought. that the Ida read the Pequain. You know, the B side was Wee Wee Hours, which is a straight 12-bar Chicago style Muddy Waters blues. You know, and it's only when he heard that demo on a little tape, when my dad and my uncle heard the Maybelline, which was called Ida Red then.
Right, right.
And the name got changed to Maybelline because that was a big cosmetic company. I guess there was a tube of lipstick, something was laying around with the Maybelline name, and they came up with it. And like I say, everything changed after that. Chest changed. It was just a major shift in my life and in the company's life.
He says in his book, which, of course, he wrote by himself with no ghost writer, he said your father, Leonard Chess, had explained that it would be better for him if he had original songs. He really encouraged him to write.
Yes, he did. And you know what else I've heard from other people, you know, because they always call Chuck Berry the father of rock and roll, one of the founding fathers. But I've heard from people that at Maybelline, it was my father who pushed for the big beat. And one of my father's studio nicknames was the foot stomper.
Uh-huh.
He'd always stomp his foot to that backbeat. So, like, you know, I'm saying, hey, my father actually had a big part in the beat of rock and roll.
Uh-huh. Did he talk to you? A couple more things and we'll let you go. Did he talk to you? I talked to Chuck once, and that was about 5-6 years ago, actually, in St. Louis. But did he talk to you about Louis Jordan? And last week we talked about how he told me how he loved the diction
influence.
Of Nat King Cole. I mean, can you talk about his influences?
Yes, he did. Louis Jordan, he mentioned to me. I when I went on the road with him, we were driving around a lot in rental cars. He talked to me about that. I asked him who was his influence. He liked country and western too.
Yeah, yeah.
He had a very eclectic taste. He was a special guy. He used to say he was Hawaiian and he was a hairdresser.
Yeah.
I mean, he was something else. And he had all that Latin influence.
I love the Latin
Moon,
stuff. I've been playing that lately. That Latin stuff was great. And, of course, Havana Moon, people know that song. But, yeah, the Latin stuff is awesome.
Yeah. He definitely was a special, very special, deserved all the awards and accolades he's gotten. King of Sweden gave him an award. I spoke 10, 12 years ago. It was the first night I'd met his wife at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They had a one-week American Masters thing. And he came with his whole family. And it was really great. You know, I hadn't seen him again in a long time, you know.
Well, thank you.
Anyway, those are some of my Chuck Berry stories. When we were on that road trip, I'll tell you a funny one, then I'm going to go to bed.
Okay,
so we're in San Francisco playing the Cow Palace. That's big, man. It was like one of the first rock and roll shows. The big disc jockeys in San Francisco were these two guys named Donahue and Mitchell. They brought alternative. They were white guys who played blues. They played early rock and roll. So we get to this motel, and the gig is the next day. And it had like a coffee shop. You know, hey, let's get Chuck. Are you hungry? Oh man, I'm not hungry at all, man. Go get yourself something. So for some reason, I had to ask him something. So I knocked on his motel door, and he opened it up. And I walked in his room, and guess what he was doing? On the windowsill, he had an electric hot plate plugged in with a can of baked beans on it. He just was so cheap sometimes, you know.
That's why he's got all that money now.
I heard he's got, I used to call him up at Barry Park, and Fran, who was the fan club secretary right at the beginning, when she was a teenager, still worked for him. Probably I'm going to meet her at the funeral. I'm going to actually go to the funeral.
Yeah.
Fran says, I said, where's Chuck? He's with his cars. I said, what do you mean? He's got most of the Cadillacs that he had in his whole career. He kept them all.
Wow.
I guess he's got them in some garage in St. Louis or at that park he has.
Yeah, that old park. Well, thanks for staying up late with us tonight on Nocturnal Journal, Marshall.
It's a pleasure, man.